One, two, three, four.
Like, I won my first Emmy when I was 21, and that was totally by absolutely devoting myself for the 2 years up to that, night and day, to doing all the scene work on every scene that I did. And I went to class at the same time, and I did plays at the same time. And then I kept doing that up until my mother died. So that whole, like, 7 year period, I think I went to Michael Howard's for 8 years. Even when I was so tired, I couldn't get up and do a scene. He would say, get up and do a poem, you know, get up and do something small. And it helped me. It helped me enormously. It saved me. The way I was trained and the way I try to train other people is that you do know when you're in the zone and you know what the zone is supposed to feel like. And it feels like flying. Oh God, it feels so good. And that's what you want. You want to be so unself-aware that you're sort of in liftoff.
Well, I had to become the father of my family very young because my parents divorced when I was 12.
My situation was a little bit unusual in that my father kind of disappeared. And I had been making a fair amount of money as a kid, doing commercials and television and film. And so we needed money, and I kind of became the breadwinner. But I had this amazing world that I had access to, which was the world of the entertainment industry. My mom was supportive of my taking over and saying, this is, I think, what we need to do. And she liked the idea of moving to New York. So I moved to New York when I was 17 with a play that I had gotten. And then she got cancer. So she got really sick and I had to take care of her then full time. And that lasted for about 8 years, and then she died when I was 25. So that was a rough go. At the same time, I had an amazing other world, and my other world was the world of make-believe and pretend and happy families and Christmases and Easters and miracles and love and weddings and children and the pretend world that I spent a very large amount of time in. It became a great way to balance what was sort of tragic in my real life.
Our guest today is Katie McLean. You probably know her from her long and celebrated career in daytime television. She's a three-time Emmy Award-winning actress. She now plays Pamela Curtis on CBS's Beyond the Gates and is the artistic director of Axial Theatre. And her directorial work includes the documentary Seeing is Believing, Women Direct, a fascinating look at the challenges and triumphs of women behind the camera. Her memoir, Murdering My Youth, is an honest and sometimes difficult book about growing up as a child actor in the spotlight. Her work across all these different art forms, acting, directing, writing, art, and music, all seem to be connected by a commitment to telling true stories, no matter how complicated. Katie McLean, welcome to The Creative Process.
Thank you so much for having me, Mia. I'm so happy to be here.
We had a chance to meet when you came over for the John Patrick Shanley acting workshop, and you're just been decades in the business and also the directing end and your theater and of course in television and film. Just going back even to the start of your acting career, you really jumped in at the deep end for your first roles, like sharing the big screen with legend Peter O'Toole in My Favorite Year. You played his daughter. If you could take us back to that. But what do you remember about that time and the excitement?
Yes, I had a very strange introduction into show business. It wasn't planned, really. I mean, as a little kid, I was a dancer. I was a tap dancer. And my very first television appearance was on the Guinness Book of World Records with about 100 or so plus other tap dancers, all tap dancing in a big arena. And I saw myself in television and thought it was the greatest thing ever. And then I just wanted to do commercials, and I booked a very, very great agent, a woman named Iris Burton, who is the best children's agent in Los Angeles. And so because of her, I started getting auditions for very high-quality shows. And I was a child. I didn't know what I was doing. But for some reason or other, she saw something special in me. It's very funny. I read a biography about her recently, and she said, you know, I never take kids that are hamburger. I only take kids that are steak, filet mignon. And I'm like, oh, great. That's wonderful.
To be seen as a piece of meat.
Exactly. It's like I learned very young. And then there was something else where she says they got to have the strength in their eyes. So she saw that I was a strong kid. And I think that was something that has helped me get through the business for my entire life, that sort of strength that you either have or you don't. So I got these amazing auditions, and the audition for My Favorite Year was at MGM, and the property is now Sony. And what can I say? It was magical. All the sets that I got to work on, walking onto Paramount and doing Cheers and working with Ted Danson and Woody Harrelson and the gang of Cheers, or working on St. Elsewhere. Or God, one of them was Anne Margaret and Frederick Forrest. And I got to work with them on a TV movie called Who Will Love My Children, about a woman who gives away her children because she has cancer and her husband's an alcoholic and can't take care of them. Very touching. And I just kept finding myself in these extraordinary places with extraordinary people. And I watched them. I learned to be an observer. And because I was a child, I wasn't the focus. I wasn't the center. But I was very happy to be there. And I didn't feel like I had to be the star of the show. But I loved being a part of it, you know?
So Who Will Love My Children must have resonated with you too, because sadly, later your mother developed cancer and you had to suddenly take that on and become the breadwinner and take charge. Just tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I had to become the father of my family very young because my parents divorced when I was 12. And because I was making money doing commercials and film and television, I kind of became the provider. And then my mother and I made a decision, and my sister was on a school on the East Coast. She was going to Yale.
My situation was a little bit unusual in that my father kind of disappeared. And I had been making a fair amount of money as a kid doing commercials and television and film. And so we needed money, and I kind of became the breadwinner. And very quickly, about by 15, I realized that my track in life needed to be different. If I was going to survive, I was going to have to really decide I was going to work for a living and not take a sort of typical, who am I, let me go to college, let me figure it all out track, because I didn't have that kind of financial support. But I had this amazing world that I had access to, which was the world of the entertainment industry. My mom was supportive of my taking over. And saying, this is, I think, what we need to do. And she liked the idea of moving to New York. So I moved to New York when I was 17 with a play that I had gotten. And then she got cancer. So she got really sick. And I had to take care of her then full time. And that lasted for about 8 years. And then she died when I was 25. So that was a rough go. At the same time, I had an amazing other world. And my other world was the world of make believe and pretend, and the world that I got to participate in on the soaps, which had happy families and Christmases and Easters and miracles and love and weddings and children and, you know, all of that, and the pretend world that I spent a very large amount of time in, became a great way to balance what was sort of tragic in my real life.
But, you know, it's a big thing. I mean, I often feel like we don't even start to know ourselves until we're kind of in our 30s. And I even meet some people and they're way beyond that, and they haven't become their mature self. So to be able to take on that world and be shoulder to shoulder with these actors who've been in it decades, and to be able to being so supportive of your family, of your mother, because you wrote a memoir, Murdering My Youth. And it strikes me, God, was that the chance that you could look back when you didn't? Because when you were in it, we're swimming in it, we don't really understand. Like, you don't really understand the things that you might have been summoning yourself, the strength, the resilience you have. People from the outside see it, but we don't often see it from the inside. So was that your chance to kind of recoup and to understand? And
I wish my 30s were not what they were in a way. I went wild in my 30s. I just pressed against the edges of nobility. I don't know what the heck I was thinking, but I had lived a very tight and controlled life where my responsibility factor was extremely high, and sometimes life or death kind of choices. My responsibility for other people's survival was very high, and I just had it to explode. If I was to write another memoir, I'd call it Days of Being Wild. And I'm not sorry, actually. I shouldn't say that I regret them, because I don't. I've just lived a different life, you know? It's like a completely different track than other people that I've met, with very rare exceptions. I can't regret it because it's made me who I am now. and I like who I am now. I'm happy now. And I feel now in my 50s, I am a person that has a sense of compassion for people who are going through difficult things. And I know a lot more about the vagaries of life. And it all kind of feeds into the art making, you know, where I'm interested in other kinds of conversations where we can go in deep and deep and deep and deep into behavior with compassion and empathy and curiosity. And in myself, you know, I can hold it or I can experience it like internally without it wounding me. When I was younger, I found, you know, Austin Pendleton was asking me like, wow, he asked me just a little bit about my upbringing and my life. And he was like, you turned out really well considering. And I didn't tell him that it actually, the pain that I was experiencing and carrying when I was younger was a stopper for me. Like, I couldn't go that far into certain kinds of creative work because I couldn't be that, not vulnerable emotionally, but vulnerable within the system of what was being asked creatively. Like, within a soap, there's a structure. The day starts this way, you have these many scenes, this is what you're supposed to do, then that is over, and everybody goes home and has dinner, right? Within a play, it's like you're going down layer after layer after layer after layer on the same material. And if you feel at all unsafe within that environment, within yourself or within the system of the people that you're working with, it can be very unsettling, very unsettling. I think I also like idolized in some way the theater. I wanted it to be better in some ways than it was. I wanted it to be the perfect place, you know, where people were good to each other. I think I've wanted that from a lot of different areas. Where's the place where we all hold hands and it's kumbaya and we're all friends and, you know, everyone's good to each other? I don't know. Maybe it's on Provincetown.
That's interesting. I think that there, and I don't know, but within soap opera, because you are dealing with big emotions too, but I feel like maybe it's also akin to comedy where you're dealing with a lot of raw material. I mean, they are, you know, real, the knives are out, I think, if I understand, with, you know, both soap opera and comedy can be about the darkest things, but in a way, maybe there is a buffer zone as well, because it can be so large that it can, you can protect yourself in a way. Is that a reading of it?
I don't know. I think it's, it sounds strange, and it's not so much comedy versus drama as it is clocking the ambition level of the people that you're working with.
Okay.
Right? And so in a soap, there's sort of like only so famous you can be. I like to jokingly say that soaps are sort of one step above porn in terms of how they're respected, you know? In New York, totally different story because all the theater people worked in soaps, you know?
Yeah.
They would come in and go out, it was a nice bit of money. And people looked different. In Los Angeles, everybody was like the beautiful and the damned. And in New York, we were sort of like the pretty good looking and the hopeful. But once you know everybody, you sort of get to know, like everybody gets ground down by the amount of work that you have to do. So that the ambition level begins to get secondary. Because what you want as an actor or as any kind of creative person is for that ambition to be tabled, like to be pushed so far away that you're not thinking about it at all. And the only thing that matters is the work. The only thing that matters is serving the material, serving the play, serving the thing that is outside you, using the things that are inside you to serve this other thing that's kind of coming from the writer, obviously first in the writer's world, but that we're meeting it, we're meeting in the same universe, right? That's the goal. Get out of your way and get to the universe and serve the universe. That's what we're supposed to do as actors. Unfortunately, there's a tendency that can come creeping around where everybody gets ambitious about something else, and it's the wrong thing, you know? Is my agent gonna come? Is this gonna get me the nighttime TV show? And it's a drag, man, you know? It's a drag. It's a drag on the play.
I imagine it can take the joy out of it, but also not serve your acting, too, because it makes you self-conscious, and you're not then in the moment. I was thinking there about what your agent had said and what she had looked for in her young actors and what Austin Pendleton had told you, like, wow, you survived that, because we all know the stories of the young actors who don't, you know, who burn out. Or even, I know that you acted with River Phoenix in a TV miniseries, Robert Kennedy and His Times, and it doesn't turn out well for so many. Was that a lesson for you, what happened to River Phoenix?
100%. And he wasn't the only one. I mean, the girls that had terrible eating disorders, or the girls and boys that were molested on sets, off sets, auditions, the things that happened to me, you know? And I think I clocked all of that pretty young. And I don't know, I just was determined. I was like, well, that's not good. Here's the thing I really learned, and it wasn't that long ago that I learned it. It really matters who you spend your time. A friend that pushes drugs or alcohol on you at any age is not your friend. A friend that tells you go to bed, you got a show tomorrow, that's your friend. So it's really important who you hang out with. I didn't learn that until very late, but I clock it now. So there was this movie called Bohemian Rhapsody about Freddie Mercury. And there was a person in Freddie Mercury's life that walked him down the dark road and then sort of stuck to him like a barnacle and kind of fed him drugs and kept him going to places where that would not have been the best choice for his life. And listen, on the one hand, you know, if you want to go crazy and explore the dark side, you know, that's your choice and go for it. But on the other hand, watch out who wants to be your best friend and who wants to, like, feed things into your ear about what you should and shouldn't do and who you should hang out with and what's cool and what's not. Because being a creative person, we're very vulnerable. We're very vulnerable to those kinds of people who are slippery and may not be of good intent, you know, and may like to watch you fail or be hurt or to actually hurt you in some way and feel like they get power over you and enjoy the feeling of power over you. And those people are out there. So you have to, as a creative person, really watch out for people like that, you know. So I saw that with a lot of young people as a child actor, watching those kids, you know, wanting to explore life. And then because they were famous, people would come around to them and sort of like moths to the light and want to feed off that light.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's fortunate then that you had your days of being wild, but later, I mean, in your 30s, that's great. You can kind of cope. The hormones are past the... You can have some clarity in all that. And so perhaps that was, you saved yourself from some of those influences. And of course, then getting out of LA and coming to New York, that was a better atmosphere for you as well. So you come to New York, you're acting the soaps, but you're also always staying in touch with theater. You mentioned there Austin Pendleton, and I know that's something that you're working on now, a new one-act play for the Summer One Act Festival.
Yeah. One of the things that brought me back to New York City was the offer to be the artistic director of a theater company called Axial Theater. And I really had retreated from theater for a little while, sort of in a way because I loved it so much. And I was focusing on other things in my life other than the soaps. I did a documentary film about female directors, and I was becoming a film director for a while. I did like 8 short films. I produced films and learned a lot about that when I was in Los Angeles. Then this COVID happened, and then this opportunity to be an artistic director for a theater company came around, and I thought, wow, that sounds really great. I have no idea what an artistic director does, but let me give it a shot. So I started directing and producing and creating these opportunities for playwrights to have readings and development readings through the theater company here in New York and upstate. That led to a lot of people here in New York City. I mean, I lived here for 25 years, and I really met an enormous amount of people. And so reconnecting with everybody was fantastic. One of the people I reconnected with was the fellow who wrote this one-act play, Walter John Thompson. And it's just a wonderful, surreal piece. I thought, well, I would love to work with Austin again. Austin wrote Orson's Shadow. Axial also put together with 6 other theater companies. A woman named Gabrielle Berberich, who's the owner of Michael Howard Studios, had said to me that I should be in Orson's Shadow. She's a friend, and I teach at Michael Howard's. This was a few years ago. You have to be in this play. I was like, oh, sure. If you're going to produce it, great. Let me know, right? I'm not producing at this moment. And then I was on the subway, and I saw a guy with an Orson Shadow flyer card, you know? And I was like, wait a minute. I was supposed to be in that play. What are you doing? So he goes, oh, we're doing it down at Theater for the New City. And so I was like, I will go. So I saw the very last performance, and it was magical. This was in March of last year. And I spoke to everyone afterwards, and I said, hey. And I happened to know other people that were there and that were involved, or friends of people that were involved. So I said, I would like to help you produce this again. So many meetings later, I produced it again with six other entities. I got to know Austin Pendleton, who wrote the play, lovely man. And we had a wonderful time. It was a beautiful production. I'm wildly proud of it. One of the members of Axial asked me to direct something at the Chain in the winter. Got to know a lot of people at the Chain. And then they said, do you want to do something in the summer? And they invited me to submit something. And I thought, oh, how about this play? And I'll act in it, and Axial will help produce it. And I'll ask Austin to direct it. And then I also asked Ryan Tremont, who is played Laurence Olivier in Orson Shadow, to act in it with me. So that's kind of how I do things, right? It's sort of like I meet you and I get to know you, and then, oh, I like you and I like your work. And I think of myself as a weaver.
It was great because talking about wanting that sense of family and community, you have to work. I mean, there is a real, now they say, the art of casting. I mean, of just getting people, teams together, which I guess is then related to also being an artistic director, but then that's beyond. But it's just seeing that chemistry and seeing how they work together, because you can't just pick someone for the role. They could be great, but they could be so problematic. So you really have to weave them, you know? You can't.
Absolutely. And that's really interesting that you should say that, because it reminds me to go back to what we were talking about in the beginning about how I was retreating from theater because I didn't like the sort of sparky ambition weirdness that would come out of people. So now I can curate these environments where the focus gets to be on what I think is the right thing, right? And the person's, like, Austin is the voice in the room. We all listen to Austin, and I kind of try to curate that environment so that everybody there realizes, like, we're so lucky to get any of his wisdom.
So you played Joan Plowright in the Orson Shadow.
That's right.
Right, so I'm just projecting myself into this time. But I do want to ask, because it's interesting, the atmosphere of, say, the acting family, which would, you know, for you were on All My Children and others, so for a long time, I don't know, is that over 600 episodes, or is that correct?
Oh, for sure.
Oh, okay. So that becomes a kind of family. And it's interesting because you said, oh, there could be a kind of absence of ego, or you're just doing so much work that you don't think about that. And I don't think that that's what people think about when they think of soap opera, because of the magnification of emotions sometimes or whatever. But it's weird because I was just reflecting on this presidency that we're going through now, and I think in some ways this is a soap opera presidency.
Oh my God, that's so funny.
All out there in the front.
Wow, that's so interesting. I've never even thought of that, but I think there's probably something to that. I really do. That's really funny.
So, yeah, it just struck me because they're what it seems to be is constantly introducing new storylines, killing off characters. you know, this thing. So, I don't know. That's what it feels like. Or I think the comparison that has been made is that it's a reality show presidency, which can also be said.
That's so interesting.
But yeah, so it's funny to think about that, because it becomes, with acting in the soaps, like a repertory that you get to know rhythm. And that's an experience that a lot of people don't get. Just tell us, what's that like to mature with the character? You're a Dixie Cooney for I don't know how many years and how many episodes. But what is that like?
That's such a nice question to ask. So the way I survived that was that every 2 years, I would just imagine she was a completely different character. And I would change my hair a lot so that I would sort of, even for myself, become a different character. Because it's really hard to play the same character. It gets boring. Even if you're being thrown into a well, or you've got to donate your kidney to your brother, or you have a miscarriage. I never intended to be on soaps for that long, for as long as I did. It wasn't my goal. I mean, I've never worked harder in my life. When they say it's like boot camp, they're not kidding. When you memorize a new script every day, 5 days a week, for 3 months in a row, that does something to your brain. It's almost painful, really. It either breaks you or you're like stronger than anybody and you're able to work faster and you're able to see things more quickly. And that part of it is great. The repertory aspect of it, you just know the crazy that you're working with. Doesn't mean everybody's not bananas, because most of them are, myself included. But you know the level of bananas that you're going to walk into. This person is going to be this kind of bananas that day, and you're going to be that kind of bananas that day. And then it can be sweet. And there's a pleasure in at least knowing what you're walking into the room to deal with. Some level of certainty. I was really lucky because I worked with a guy named Michael Knight. And many years later, he told me that I taught him how to write. I've always credited him with him teaching me how to write. We would sit in our dressing rooms and work the dialogue, which we were allowed to do at that time. Now that is not okay. But we earned the right, or they gave us the right, to rework our dialogue slightly and even rework a scene slightly. Sometimes we would rewrite entire scenes so that we could really create something that we felt was at the level of what their intention was, and if not, even superseded. That was great. Those were really, really creative times, and I really enjoyed that. I loved the people that I worked with, James Mitchell, Ruth Warwick, who was in Citizen Kane. James Mitchell was one of the great dancers of the 50s in the movies and on Broadway. Wonderful man. Eileen Hurley, who was a great Broadway actress up until 1970. She was like a star of Broadway. Mary Thicket, another fantastic actress on All My Children. They're the ones that were my on-set teachers in terms of what you're expected to bring to the set. So it wasn't light. It wasn't small. You were expected to bring integrity and to do the work. That's what I grew up with, and I'm really glad that I did.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. And it's rare to be able to act an arc of a life like that. I mean, it's very rare that you get to see something that you really can grow with a character. But it's not a usual experience, I think.
It's very unusual. A year on any kind of TV show is like, wow, I've worked on this TV show for a year, you know? I worked on All My Children. I keep losing count of it, but, you know, I think it was like 13 years, which is a lot of time. It wasn't intentional, and sometimes it feels like another lifetime ago. But I'm grateful for it, you know.
And now you're in Beyond the Gates, and so this is, just tell us the evolution of this and your character.
Beyond the Gates is a new soap opera that focuses on an affluent African-American family in the suburbs of Washington, D.C. And I play the best friend of one of the leads. My character's name is Pamela Curtis, and she is very fabulous and a little bougie and very pretentious, but she's a great friend to her friend, and all she cares about is her friend's well-being. And the head writer, Michelle Valjean, is someone I've known for a really long time, and so it was really wonderful for us to be able to make this happen. I fly down to Atlanta a couple times a month and shoot a couple episodes. I'm still able to do my theater work and other work that I do and teach, but they've been really great and helpful, allowing me to keep all my worlds rolling at the same time. But it's a lot of fun, and it's a different kind of soap opera. They use the same cameras that they used for the Mission Impossible movie, Maverick. So no soap has ever been shot with these kinds of film cameras before. So they've really reinvented the medium to some degree. So it's kind of like half a nighttime show and half a daytime show. So it's really impressive. And Tamara Tooney's on it. I worked with Tamara on As the World Turns many years ago. So that's really fun. I know a lot of the people on the show. So it's been an amazing adventure, and I'm super happy to get to dip in and out of a medium that I've known for so long. And people seem to be really enjoying it. I mean, Entertainment Weekly, I think, called it one of the top 25 TV shows coming out of America right now, which is exciting. And they've done articles about why this is culturally important, because it's really, like, with what's been going on politically, it's taking a stand for a whole kind of community of people that have also been otherized and not othering them whatsoever. So that's super exciting.
Well, congratulations on that. And the other one is because I know that you were a native of Los Angeles, and now what's happening in Los Angeles, speaking of othering, speaking of detention camps, speaking of rounding up, you know, illegal immigrants, but also legal ones and sending them off, you know, to foreign countries. You know, that must be troubling for you because I think you had many generations of your family from Los Angeles, and to see that happening now, of course, it's not just in Los Angeles now.
So I am part Mexican. My father spoke fluent Spanish and I grew up in Southern California. And what I think people tend to forget, and it's crazy that they forget it, is that it was once Mexico. Los Angeles is not English. Right? It is a Spanish name for a city, right? San Diego is not an English name. These are Spanish names. It's bizarre. It's all I can say is what's happening is bizarre and disturbing and wildly concerning and a super dark time for our country. And there's a lot of people doing a lot of things about it and speaking up about it, which I'm really happy about. I'm happy to lend my name to that. All it takes is a shift. You're like, okay, now we're not just doing this demographic. Now we're doing this demographic. And there's all kinds of stuff that's like, the dumbing down of America, returning to a brute force type of America. And I'm not for it, not at all. But the only thing that I know how to do is to keep making art. That's all I know how to do. Like, if you keep making art, if you keep telling stories, if you keep connecting people, if you keep supporting. I have a friend who's making a documentary about what happened to the civics program in public schools. Nobody knows the branches of government anymore. Can't name them. So we have a problem on our hands that has a lot to do with the education level of our giant community, so that they don't know enough to know why what's happening is wrong, right? That's kind of the bigger problem.
We have to have an engaged citizenry. And I did have an interesting conversation with the head of Stanford's Deliberative Democracy Lab, because the thing is, people feel disconnected from the democratic process. So it's like, why should I learn that? Because it's all like lobbyists, or it's all special interests, or it's all corporatization run by billionaires. Anyway, the deliberate democracy now can be helped with AI, which is one of the good things AI can do, is you can have panels of 10 people and have a moderator that's just like AI that makes sure nobody gets out of hand. You're given information packs that is unbiased, that's not promotional materials, and you can vote within this. They've done it in America and in countries around the world. You know, you get people from all sides. They have an opinion going in. They're presented with information, they have conversations, they have limited time sets to speak and give their point of view. Some people feel more confirmed in their point of view, but others do change their mind. And so this is a real civil society, and this is real civil discourse that seems to be lacking even from legacy media. You know, it's going towards more clickbait and rage to engage. So that's kind of hopeful. And it can really be scaled out with the use of AI moderators. I'd love to see more of that, not just voting election, but voting on many subjects that require nuance and information. I think that there is a will, but we just have to ask for it. There are vehicles for doing that.
That's fantastic. Well, I want to continue to hear what you learn from your perspective, because about that, and I'll be happy to share what's going on from my perspective as well, what I hear people talking about or doing in order to help engage the citizenry in a way in which we're conversing as opposed to seeking to destroy or seeking to humiliate, but instead seeking to understand. I think that's, without the other person getting their back up, so much about why this other person thinks differently. And I cannot say that I am free of occasional, like, I just don't necessarily always want to talk to people who have such a completely different way of looking at the world. Sometimes I'm just like, I just don't have time for that. So I'm probably a lot like a lot of people who just don't want to have to sit and hear opinions that feel like they contradict their basic value structure. But I think that we all are going to have those conversations in order to move ourselves closer to each other, because I think we're so back in our corners. And the other thing I would add to that is the biggest challenge, and I think the thing that we have to all fight, is cynicism. cynicism or like, oh, it's all screwed up. It's all over with now. If you don't continue to make efforts towards building a better world, then those people who would benefit by owning everything can just easily swoop in and go, thank you, you didn't care.
Yeah, we have to do a lot more caring, a lot more listening. And I think the skills of theater and the arts definitely teach us that. We all need that quiver in our bow. While you're acting, you're developing your writing skills. You're constantly on set. So you spoke of your directing, and that serves your work now as an artistic director. You're directing, and you did that documentary that you mentioned, interviewing other women directors, really notable ones too. And you're picking up all these other skills, like you didn't intend to be there, but you're picking up all these other things as well. You're just absorbing it.
I mean, so a couple of things happened while I was on the soaps. I had two agreements with myself. One was, if you're going to do this in order to take care of your family, you're going to do two things. You're going to be the best at what you do. You're not going to half-ass it. And you're also going to keep training, and you're going to keep doing other projects. So I set those standards for myself, so that I would not sink into a kind of mediocrity that would depress me. I just wasn't able to not push myself to my absolute and total potential. I couldn't live with that. For whatever reason, there was a voice in my head that said, it is not okay or not enough to be pretty good. So that comes at a cost. I mean, that's like an engine that not everybody has. I can't understand why I have it, and I can't apologize for it, but I think it's kind of a relief to admit it. It might have a great deal to do with my childhood. Like, I won my first Emmy when I was 21, and that was totally by absolutely devoting myself for the 2 years up to that, night and day, to doing all the scene work on every scene that I did. And I went to class at the same time, and I did plays at the same time. And then I kept doing, after that, plays and readings and going to class up until my mother died. When, you know, so that whole like 7 year period, I went to Michael Howard's for eight years. Even when I was so tired, I couldn't get up and do a scene. He would say, get up and do a poem, you know, get up and do something small. And it helped me. It helped me enormously. It saved me. It was like a place for process, where I had to always constantly be delivering product. I could rest in the soft arms of process. And that was amazing for me.
And so you do many different modes of writing. It's not just like script writing, but poetry, songwriting. When you're producing as well, that's all writing. All the stuff that helps bring a project into the world, there's always writing and storytelling involved. So tell us a little bit about those different modes. How do you approach writing a poem or a song compared to the other forms of storytelling?
So I started writing poems in my early 20s. Poems for me are like fairies almost. They're like little whispering visitors, and they kind of come in and beg to be written. I think I found poetry also a way to buffer myself against words that didn't feel elegant. So it gave me an opportunity to sort of craft with elegance, to try to find a way to say something succinctly and beautifully and give words love. Sometimes words kind of have their own energy. When you step into their elegance, they can release a certain beauty, right, for the listener and for you when you're crafting them. I think I really used poetry to be able to also express things for me that were not beautiful, and I needed to give them beauty.
It's so interesting. It's like an act of distillation. I know that you also explored poetry. You performed in Inventions of a Farewell. It's a piece based on the poetry of Wallace Stevens.
Yeah.
We were involved in the adaptation process because, again, different modes of writing, you have to translate it from the different forms to make it work in living language in that way.
So Inventions of Farewell was the poetry of Wallace Stevens, put together by the director Estep Nagy, who is now a novelist, very well-regarded novelist. At the time, I really loved, and I still do, experimental theater. So we did this down at Here Theater in New York City, which is known for its experimental pieces. I really loved it. I loved memorizing that work and trying to find a way to communicate it as an actor. It's hard because it's meant to be read. It's meant to be in your eye. And so hearing it, I think, is, and watching an actress try to interpret it, you know, was a challenge. But people seem to really enjoy it, and I certainly enjoyed doing it. And I found out about Wallace Stevens that he was a banker.
I should know that.
Yeah. No, most people don't. He worked at a bank, and he wrote poetry on the side. And it gave me a lot of hope, because I sort of felt like working on a soap was working at a bank or the post office, you know. It had a slightly lower estimation in terms of one's day job. And even if it was acting, it was a job. And though I know people might think that that's insane, but it felt that way. It felt like a grind. You had to show up, you know, regular gig. And that he was able to keep his artistic life very pure because of that, because he didn't have to use his artistic life to make money, right? Because when you use your artistic life to make money, it can affect what you make.
Actually, we just posted about the cinematographer Benoit Delhomme, who's been on our show. I don't know if you know his cinematography at Eternity's Gate and Theory of Everything. Beautiful, but he's also a painter. For many, many years, he's a painter. So his paid work is what he considers the cinematography, and he's also directed. But his paintings, which he doesn't exhibit, although they're huge. And he has a freedom of, like, no one has to tell him what to do with it. It's for his pleasure. He takes it very seriously, committed, but he doesn't have that kind of commercial pressure, which is nice. So he feels he gets to enjoy the full freedom of it.
That's exactly what I think all artists need. I mean, unless you're Francis Ford Coppola, certainly the cinematography that he's making is high art, right? That's high art. But there is this additional element, you know, when you think of all of these things as games, even the art making is a kind of a game, the element of the financial pressure or the time pressure or any problems, conflicts, mistakes, or disasters all become a part of the game. And so you're overcoming those things or managing those things in order to play the game. So the game of the one-on-one of painting or even writing without a desire to sell it is just you.
Yeah, and it's nice because something else that Paul Hirsch, the film editor, told me, and he was Star Wars, he got the Oscar for, but he did, like, I think 13 Brian De Palma films and many films, but he had noticed, and that's, he said, oh, I never wanted to be a director because it's the business of art. You know, you're always trying to make the deal, once in a while getting to the act, but you get good at the auditioning, whatever, you get the good at the, I don't know, the deal making. And so there is something to it. It's hard to keep the poetry part of it alive when you have to do that aspect.
That's absolutely right. And I love that, actually, that you called auditioning like deal making. That's going to change the way I audition. Auditioning is such a difficult game, and for me and for so many, in which I feel now where we're auditioning through the screen, you're not even meeting in person, you're not getting any kind of sense of an energy of a person through this limited visual. It's a different kind of game.
Well, what is your approach to auditioning? I mean, I guess it depends on which, whether it's theater or television or film.
I try to do it as little as possible. It's why I make my own work. I make my own work. And I sort of feel like I can make my own work. And I do make my own work. And a lot of my work that I make comes from people that I already know. Or they know me. People call me up and come do this or that, or I call them up and say, I want to do this or that, because I don't know, I just don't love the auditioning game.
Yeah, but it is very interesting. I think if you can approach it as a role, I thought it was clever. I heard that J.B. Smoove, who was on Curb Your Enthusiasm, he approached it. The moment he walked in the door, he was that character, Leon, I think, in Curb Your Enthusiasm. Mm-hmm. He was, and that's a pretty full-on character. So, like, it wasn't like, oh, thank you for seeing me. It was just, and he took charge. I think that's clever because, like, there is no end. You're there, lost in the painting already.
Yeah. I mean, I remember the auditions and things that I got and roles that I booked and through the audition process, and they were a lot like that. You really, it's just full commitment, complete immersion, you know, total dedication. You're booking it. You're the character. Go. And I loved winning those parts. And it did definitely feel like a competition that you had to win the role. And at those times when I did that, and I was committed to that game, but now I like to make things happen from a different side. When I cast, when I'm directing, I don't audition people. I meet people. And I just talk to them, and I can tell right away from having a conversation whether they can act or not.
Yeah, it's an interesting skill, I think, that other people, it's the skill of listening too. It's not just the performing, is the listening, the reacting, and engaging, right? And I think that, I mean, arts education is under threat, of course. It's notoriously underfunded anyway. But I think that those are skills that, you know, the skills of empathy, the skills of listening, the skills of being a human being instead of an AI algorithm. These are things we have to nurture. And what have they given you? Because it's not something we have a lot of space for in our education models.
I don't know anything else other than this world of listening and empathy and storytelling. Like, it's my whole world. It's all I do all the time. And so it surprises me when I discover that the way that people can communicate or connect to each other is so limited that they don't want to go all the way down the deep dive. They want to keep things sort of shallow. But it's where what we do as artists becomes the service to them. Right? People, filmmaking is an empathy machine. The superpower of theater is to show sometimes the worst aspects of ourselves to a room full of people so that they can confront the worst aspects of themselves, have a cathartic experience, and walk out of the door and go, oh my God, I don't have to be that way anymore. I could be a different way, which I just think is brilliant. And so we're not like proselytizing and we're not telling people how they should be, but just trying to help audience members, people who want to come and interact with what we do, to have a moment of evolving emotionally in some regard. And I think that is something that AI can't do. Even though film is, can, you know, you can emulate Gladiator and you can have a catharsis of from your violence, I suppose, but that's not enough. We are, as human beings, made up of finer stuff than that. And I think this kind of world that's being spun now is trying to tell us that we're not, that we're made of clay and wood and would be happy with a, you know, a burger and a porn.
It's kind of dehumanizing. And what I want to say, it's not just human, but the theater, the performing arts, and all the arts, I think, is an embodied intelligence, which we forget when we, I think, therefore I am, I'm all stuck up in my head. But, you know, I've watched these videos, I don't know if you've seen them. It's a French musician, he's called Plumes Officielles, and he plays to animals. He takes his pink guitar, and
I've seen him.
Yeah. And you've seen. So he's and the horses all come. You know, they get, they're drawn. They wrap themselves around him. You know, they kiss his, sniff his guitar. What's happening out of your magic pink guitar? The lemurs. You know, so it's not just us. There's no exchange. Like, he's not feeding them, but he's nourishing them with this healing music. And they're like, there's vulnerability and emotion in all animals. And I'm sure you've had this in your dramatic training, and I want to talk about that too, is that they're even actors too. They're so physical actors. It's so funny to watch them. I was watching Cats the other day, you know, these videos, but they, you know, they kind of, they try to like tap you on the shoulder or something, and then they pretend, I didn't do that. I was just scratching my, you know, like they're acting, you know. They're playing this little game. So it's so funny to see that. So we're all like actors, I think. Yeah. There's a sense of play. Yeah. But tell me a little bit about your teachers, because you mentioned Michael Howard, and I know you also, I think, taught at his acting school as well. He was your teacher. Just tell me.
I just want to touch on the animal aspect of what you were talking about just for a minute. I had a dog for 16 years that I loved so much, and he was dying. The lady who came to help him transition said, you know, I believe animals are sentient beings. And I love that expression, sentient beings, you know, thinking, feeling, spiritual. beings just like us in a different form. And so they respond and they teach us about our sensitivities in a very pure way. Beautiful mirrors in that way.
I agree.
Right? I do teach at Michael Howard Studios, where I was a student for those 8 years. And it's a beautiful full circle. It's here in New York City, and I teach in their conservatories and Monday night scene study class. It's a beautiful experience because as I keep acting, I get to bring what I learn in my rehearsal process or my history of, you know, my work as an actor to actors who are training. It's wonderful. It's sort of like continuing to flip roles. I'm the student, I'm the teacher, I'm the student, I'm the teacher. And I teach what I most need to learn, and then I get to go practice what I just taught so that I'm embodying it. And then we just develop so much empathy in that room for the process of confronting the things that block us from being the artists that we know inside that we are. It's kind of the process of studying is a self-confrontation. And then in front of other people, trying to use the tools and the craft of acting to get out of your own way, get out of the tension in your body, the decisions that you made about who you are, or even what a scene is, removing those obstacles so that the beauty of your own humanity can come through. Using the words on the page.
And so tell me, because you said there that you were just always in this acting or this theater world where so it's like you were always in the arts from your earliest memories. And so it can kind of be, as you said, you can't separate it from it. It's part of your life. It's woven, to use that metaphor that you said. So can you just tell us what you were like as a young girl, as a young person? I mean, were you even, like, sometimes these talents, you're not even aware of them. It's pointed out to you by people.
It's funny. I have a lot of different memories I can call on for this, but I've been told that this is occasionally true for other actors, in that there's a weird combination of being extraordinarily shy and then wildly outgoing, and just depending on the circumstance, like a huge amount of courage that you can call upon for some reason or other. And it's something, as a child, I was able to rally and enjoyed rallying it. Like, if anybody was afraid of doing something, I was the one who wasn't afraid of doing it. And in terms of creativity, I was very fortunate that I had a mother who was a painter and an artist. And so we had piano, we had guitar, we had an auto harp, we had a recorder, you know, it was the 70s. And we were encouraged to go to the library and read and draw, paint. And I was already just, you know, writing poetry as a child. I mean, and I drew all the time as a kid. Sometimes I think I miss my calling, you know, that I should have been a cartoonist or an illustrator. Like, that would have been, if the acting wasn't around, that probably would have been my path. And I did end up going to School of Visual Arts, and I was there for like a year and a half. I went to the Art Students League and did life drawing and collage and all kinds of stuff. And I still do it. I still do it. As a kid, I just didn't think that any of the arts were necessarily unattainable. I understood right away that everything had like a pattern and a structure. And if you just figured out the pattern and the structure of it, then you could go inside of it and push. But I wasn't a natural. I was more natural with words. I was more natural with performing. It just, that was just the way my brain worked. Well, my sister is an academic, you know. She was always somebody who was studying and reading. And she taught me how to read, which was great. And then my mom took us to galleries and museums constantly, and to the theater. So because of her, I had access to, and a feeling that those things were accessible. You know, that they existed, and then if you wanted to participate in those worlds, it was just a matter of figuring out how, which I love.
No, that's so great, because it's really empowering, and it's a rare experience that a lot of parents don't give that kind of, you know, that they want their children not to enter a world of risk, because it's also very competitive, I mean, it must be said. So speaking of some of those other loves, you brought together art and poetry and conversations with the invisible and Licht, these books that you wrote. And I don't have to say illustrated because it's your art, but it's not like you illustrated something else. It's the two together. You know, what inspired you to bring them together in book form?
That's so lovely. Thank you so much for asking about those, because they really are books that I feel very proud of. I love combining art forms. Like when you put two things that you don't think should be together necessarily together and they can talk to one another. That to me is very exciting. So putting my collage work next to a poem, like you could use words or you could use a picture, or the picture enlightens the words or the words enlighten the picture in some way and creates a different experience for the viewer. And for me, in terms of the making of them, I think it was just a piece of me that absolutely needed to express itself in that way.
Yeah. And I'm just wondering, of all these forms, because we mentioned a little bit about your music. For those who haven't heard, it's kind of like Joni Mitchell, or in that this very quiet, kind of almost confessional singer-songwriting. And I wonder which of your different modes of expression does it feel most, I don't want to say autobiographical, but like, are you most vulnerable in sharing? Like, you feel a little bit naked about it being out there.
I mean, every time something is new, I think you feel a bit of the naked quality of it, and you're hoping that it will be embraced in some way. I think if you're doing it right, I'm not sure if it's the form that is the naked quality of it quite so much as it is the intent. And that's really helpful. It's a helpful question for you to ask me, because I feel like I can trick myself sometimes with the TV work. I have like layers of cover where I'm safe behind a mask of makeup, crazy hairdo. You know, you're wearing this costume that's like totally not you, right? And so you can hide in a way behind that. With theater, you want to feel that level of vulnerability. It's almost like if your intent is not to have tapped into yourself on some level where you're taking a risk to expose something, you haven't done the work, you haven't gone all the way, you know? I think with the poetry, and certainly with the book that I wrote, that was extremely scary, but necessary, because I had to sort of tell people about the pain. It was just my thing. Like, some people want to hide that. I understand it's not everybody's thing to like, hey, let me tell you about my pain. But I just felt like, no, hang on. This is extraordinary. It's going to be funny. And that is one of those things where I like, that I love. That's my favorite thing, is to write and make myself laugh when something is that like embarrassingly true, you know?
Yeah. It's nice when the time has passed, or even in the moment, like this is just so absurd. I can't, it's beyond. And so you just have, what else can you do but just laugh?
And it's honest. It's the honesty is the trick of it. The honesty.
Yeah, and you talked about getting to a place of no ego. You talked about, you know, stripping away, where I wonder, I feel like it must be like a fine line with acting, but I know it from my own experience of other mediums, where sometimes you can do something and you think it's throwaway. Like with acting, you're just like, it's maybe if you've done it so many times, it's become part of you. And you think you haven't, you've dialed it in or whatever. But actually that one where you're just kind of, it has your own momentum because you're not studying each step and you're not worrying about whether you can fly or whatever. You just are doing it. And sometimes that can be like the greatest thing. People say, oh, that's so natural. That's just so surprising. Did you know you did this? And you aren't even aware of it. I mean, do you get that experience? And it's just, it made me think about it when you talked about abandoning the ego or getting to a place where you don't even know it's great.
Yeah, well, I think the way I was trained and the way I try to train other people is that you do know when you're in the zone, and you know what the zone is supposed to feel like, and it feels like flying. It feels like flying. And that's what you want. You want to be so unself-aware that you're sort of on liftoff, right? Oh God, it feels so good. And in a way, any praise is almost sort of meaningless, right? Because you're like, I know I was flying and it felt great and that was fun and I'm glad you enjoyed it too, right? I want you to have been able to have that sense of liftoff with me. So if you did, then I did my job.
My name is Sasha Nikolai, and I am a student at UCLA in Los Angeles, California, majoring in communications and minoring in film and television. My true passion is for acting. I've been performing in theater and done acting for the camera my whole life. Listening to Katie McLean speak about her journey as an artist and an actress is inspiring to me as she speaks about her determination, courage, talent, and work against the odds to have achieved such success with such longevity. As I look into an endless sea of self-taped digital auditions and competition amongst my peers and within the industry, it is undoubtedly overwhelming and scary. Katie McLean speaks to this aggressiveness or deal-making that she was never fond of in the theater industry. Yet, she focuses more on the spirit of being a performer, reminding me that, all in all, with enough volition and intention, my acting is in my hands. Katie McLean truly speaks from her heart and with deep wisdom about a certain moment in acting where you feel like you are flying. By becoming so unself-aware and knowing this extraordinary universe within and then sharing it, I can say that I remember the first time that I felt this way. I was 14, playing Mother Courage in Bertolt Brecht's Mother Courage. I had realized after the show that in a deep inward way, I was still in character, and the character was me. This experience was so profound to me as I felt the emotional weight of my character in myself. There is such a beauty to understanding human nature in this way through art. The empathy and seeing emotional complexity and becoming naked in the vulnerability of artistic presentation in all of its forms. Like Katie, I love to draw, paint, write poetry, and sing. I feel I can resonate so well with her comments on the importance of combining artistic mediums and carrying through in the impulse to create. I feel grateful for this creative spark within me and for being given the opportunity to acknowledge a great creative. Now, let's get back to the interview.
That must be such a rush. I don't know what that feels like, you know, the tightrope walking of performing and then performing live too. Well, you have to have courage for that. I guess, you know, speaking of courage and thinking about the future and the kind of world we're leaving the next generation, you know, it's uncertain times. And so as you think about the future and the kind of world we're leaving for the next generation, what would you like young people to know, preserve, and remember?
I was teaching class the other day, and the students did not know who Laurence Olivier was.
Oh, wow.
So I think we have a job to do in terms of making sure that the younger generation know history, because the history of the arts, the history of the greats, not just recent history, but our collective, you know, what we said, we all agreed at a time, this person did something remarkable. Those who forget their history are doomed to repeat it. But also that these people left markers along the road as to what is truly valuable. It wasn't just about them and their ego and what they wanted to achieve. It was about what they dug for, what they thought was worthwhile, what stories they felt were important to tell and why, because there's a universality to those themes and those stories that are important. It's why we revisit Shakespeare over and over and over again. We explore to know our humanity, and I would like them to not give up on the value of those things. They're not replaceable. You know, each individual has an extraordinary universe inside, and that their only job is to know it and share it. So for the betterment of us all, right? Because some people say, and I think this is a beautiful way of thinking of things, that we are all God mirroring ourselves back to ourselves in order to know it better. So how can, if I'm God and I'm lonely, how can I know myself better or expand or become more beautiful or even refine myself in terms of my creations if I don't know you, if I don't see you, if you don't glow, if you don't shine, if you don't show me, I don't know that star system, I don't know that music. You have a part of the greatness inside of you, just like I have a part of it inside of me, and we kind of make it all seen when we allow ourselves to be fully expansive in that regard.
I think that's true. I think that those, we call it the spirit, or so many traditions have a different name for it, but I think that is conversations with the invisible, like you were saying. And I actually just posted something on that today. You know, everything visible, it's a Magritte quote, conceals or hides something invisible. And we're all part of it. We just can't see all the connections. I think that's a beautiful thought to end with. So thank you, Katie McLean, for sharing your creative journey, your vulnerability and strength, and showing how we can tap into our intuitive intelligence so we may grow as actors, as people. By understanding our common humanity, we can create a better tomorrow. Thank you for adding your voice to the creative process.
It's my pleasure, Mia. Thank you for such wonderful questions and giving me the opportunity to reflect on some wonderful topics and share some of my story. I appreciate it so much. Thank you.
The Creative Process Podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation. This interview was conducted by Mia Funk with the participation of collaborating universities and students. Associate interview producer on this episode were Katie Foster and Sasha Nikolai. The Creative Process is produced by Mia Funk. Additional production support by Sophie Garnier. Wintertime was composed by Nicholas Anadolis and performed by the Athenian Trio. We hope you enjoy listening to this podcast. If you'd like to get involved with our creative community exhibitions, podcasts, or submit your creative works for review, just follow us on Instagram @creativeprocesspodcast. And send us a DM. Thanks for listening.